UK Wine Show, show number 139. China. On this week's Wine Show, we're talking with viticulturalist Richard Smart about China.
And in the news, Harpers to Merge, Saint-Emilion arguments almost over, and rain at last in Oz Vineyards.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 139 for the 16th of January, 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's Wine Show, we're talking with Richard Smart. Richard, as you may recall, is a viticulturalist, and he's been analysing the climate suitable for vine growing in China. We're going to be talking with him about the future of Chinese wines. In the spotlight, we're looking at how to taste wine. If you recall, we started a wee while ago looking at terroir, then we moved on to where the flavours come from. Now, we're looking at how you can enjoy wine by using your senses, eyes, nose and mouth. We start this week by looking at the wine. And finally, this week's quote is, "Good wine is a good familiar creature, if well used." What writer wrote this? Clues throughout the show, answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. William Reid Business Media is to merge Harper's with Wine and Spirit magazine to create a new fortnightly trade magazine for drinks professionals to be launched on 20th of February 2009. The magazine will have a new look and new title, Harper's Wine and Spirit Trades Review, and will be edited by Richard Siddle, who is the current editor at Harper's. The move follows the purchase of Harper's by WRBM in November last year.
We'll give you an update on that when we see the first copy of it on the 20th of February. We do subscribe to Harper's, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with the rest of our weekly subscription and whether we just get it fortnightly now. What's next, Jane?
Well, it's hoped that above average rainfall across Australian vineyards will help rebuild water levels during a long period of drought in the region and after two consecutive months of rainfall below 50% of the average. In November 2008, rainfall was up 27% on the average, bringing the aggregate rainfall since May down by 19%. It's hoped the rains will increase the low levels of stored water, but forecasts for rain through to February 2009 are mixed. In Western Australia, the chance of exceeding average rainfall is higher than in the southeast. The report was issued by the Australian Wine and Brandy Corporation in December 2008.
The drought hasn't exactly broken, but it does feel if it's on the wane. But whether the Murray Darling can supply all the water requirements for the huge inland growing areas of Australia is probably a moot point. In a country that is scarce of water, demand is always going to try and exceed supply. The question is to ensure that what little water they have is used in the most economically and ecologically sound manner. And while the price of water in Australia has risen, the ecology has taken a hit. Many people believe that the long-term future of Australian viticulture is not the hot inland regions, but by the coast, producing less but high-quality fruit than the average southeastern Australian wine. And Australia has a golden opportunity at the moment to start this process. With the Australian and New Zealand dollars quite weak, imports are going to look quite attractive in the UK. What's the last story about Saint-Emilion, Jane?
Well, the eight demoted Saint-Emilion chateaux that were to be reinstated to their 2006 reclassifications will now almost certainly remain with their lower 1996 classifications. The French Government Council has dismissed a proposal to reinstate the 2006 classifications, which was submitted as part of a finance law amendment passed in December. This latest ruling in the ongoing saga looks as though the writing is on the wall for the eight chateaux, although there is still a decision pending on an appeal with a local Bordeaux court. That's it from me this week, but as always, don't forget, you can see these stories on our website, www.3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. This has been a bun fight of epic proportions. If you recall, the 2006 classification was thrown out by the courts as being unfair. So, those who were promoted have missed out. Ultimately, though, if you're doing something like this, all wines should be tasted blind, and not by people with a vested interest in the wineries. That said, the famous 1855 classification of Bordeaux wasn't exactly neutral. Perhaps next time we need to do the classification, it may be unbiased. But classifying wine is not that easy. And when people are assessing wine, they need to use three senses: the eyes, the nose, and the mouth. How it looks, how it smells, and how it tastes. In the first of a three-part series, we're going to be looking at the different senses to see what you can learn about the wine. In part one, we're going to be looking at what you can see with our eyes and what we can learn about the wine. So, in the spotlight, let's have a look at the eyes. Our eyes can pick up a range of colours in wine, but it's not just what colour it is, red, white, rosé, that you can get from the wine. We can learn about the age, condition, and style of the wine. In blind tastings, this can be very useful to give people clues about the grape varieties and the winemaking style. Usually, we divide the wine world up into three easy colours: white, rosé, and red. While this is a good first attempt, this general colour really matches with wines. Have you ever seen a milky white wine? Rosé, we call it rosé, but the rose is technically two-thirds red, one-third blue, and is quite a garish pink colour. While most young red wines sold are in fact more bluish and purple in colour. Let's start with white wine though. Obviously it isn't white, and often comes from green or yellow grapes. Although red grape varieties can produce white wine. So what is meant? Normally, most wine experts would describe white wine ranging in colour from lemon green, lemon, gold, amber, and brown. Some very, very young wines often look pretty clear, but even the clearest looking white wine may have a faint tinge to it. A young white wine will often be clear with a tinge of lemon or lemon green. As the wine ages, it becomes more golden colour. Straw yellow is a common shade of wine with moderate aging, while gold is a characteristic of good wines in their mature state. In addition, a wine can be turned a golden colour by being placed into an oak barrel. The wine picks up the colour from the wood. It's sort of the same way as the clear whiskey turns golden brown when exposed to oak barrels. In rosés and red wines, colour leaches from the skins into the juice, changing the colour of the juice. The wine might be called rosé, but it is actually the classic shade of wines with short skin contact. Leaving the wine in contact with the skin slightly longer, the wine will actually develop a strawberry colour. Wines made from very dark-skinned grapes may also show a salmon colour, and dark-skinned varieties with short contact can have an orange colour as well. A browning to onion skin can show that the wine has matured or oxidised a wee bit. We may call young red wines red, but often they've got a blue colour to them. As the wine ages, that blue fades, leaving the wine quite red in colour. As wine oxidises, it takes on a brownish colour. By the time the wine is brown, it is getting very old, likely to be oxidised, and past its best. Even tawny wines, apart from port, are likely to be near the end of their life, but possibly still drinkable. But what controls the colour of the wine? The colour in wine comes from three categories. First are the anthocyanins. This is the colour that comes from the grapes and usually the skins. They leach out of the skins when they're left in contact with the juice. Anthocyanins are very reactive and not stable. They react with both sulphur dioxide and oxygen, which bleach them. That is, they turn clear, losing colour. During fermentation, the anthocyanins react with yeast-derived products and polyphenolics, of which tannins are the most common. These create more stable pigmented polymers, and they are very important in forming stable colours in wine. The third group of colours are known as anthocyanin-derived pigments, which arise from reactions between anthocyanins and other phenolics and aldehydes. These are quite reactive and can form further combinations with tannins to form pigmented polymers. In young red wines, density colour is based on two factors: the amount of skin contact the wine has had, and with most anthocyanins in the red grapes in the skin, leaving the juice in contact with the skins for long periods helps leach colour from the skin. The second key factor is the level of sulphur dioxide in the wine. Sulphur dioxide bleaches wine, removing the colour, so high levels will create a lighter coloured wine. The acidity or pH in the wine can also influence the colour, although this is not as pronounced as skin contact or sulphur dioxide. In young red wines, anthocyanins occur predominantly as a dynamic equilibrium in five major states. One is bonded to sulphur dioxide, and four are free forms. Most forms are colourless within the normal pH range of wine, i.e. the level of acidity in the wine. Red wine colour comes primarily from small proportions of anthocyanins that exist in a state known as flavulums. The proportion of this state depends on the pH and the free sulfur dioxide in the wine. Low pH, i.e. quite high acidity, increases the concentration of flavulum state, enhancing the red colour. As the pH rises, the colour density and proportion of anthocyanins in the flavulum state decreases rapidly. Another state of anthocyanin is quinordal and is responsible for the blue colours in wine that often occur at high pHs. As I said earlier, anthocyanins readily react with tannins and other polyphenols. This polymerization or connecting up forms chains and is similar to the effect that tannins undergo as they age, making the tannin molecules larger, and it also changes the tannins to make them softer and less harsh. But for wine, the making of long chains is important to stabilize the wine's color by protecting the anthocyanin from oxidation. Polymerization makes anthocyanins more resistant to bleaching from sulfur dioxide at high pH. In addition, anthocyanins are more colored when connected to tannins. Polymerization increases the proportion of both flavulum, the red colors, and quinodal, the blue states. However, polymerization and oxidation change the color of red wines to a yellowy-brown color. Combined with the loss in red and blue colors, the yellow-brown flavulum and quinodal anthocyanin tannin polymers result in wine progressively taking on a brickish red shade. That ends this week's Spotlight. I hope that sort of explains to you some of the processes in chemistry that's going on to change the wine colours. Next week, we're going to be looking at the taste of wine, so stay tuned for that. We'll try and explain the differences in taste in the mouth. But how are you getting on with the quote? Good wine is a good familiar creature if it's well used. Now, I'm after the person who wrote this. He is a famous English writer from 1564 to 1616, and I'm not going to give you too many clues, but the character in the play who said this was called Iago. That should give you a big clue if you know your plays. I hope that helps you getting the quote. Next up, we've got a chance to find out about China. We talk with viticulturist Richard Smart about China. Richard has been looking for suitable climates in China, and we talked to him about the regions, what to look out for, and what is driving the Chinese wine industry. Let's have a listen to what Richard has to say. Hi, I'm here with Richard Smart. You're a viticulturalist, quite a famous viticulturalist, and you've been doing some work in China recently. What's the situation with China?
Well, China's a very big grape producer. I think they're about number 7 in the world. I think they're just behind Australia. We don't hear much about them. Their wines aren't exported. The Chinese don't drink much wine. And most of the grapes they grow are table grapes. But for all of that, they've had a wine industry for quite a few decades now. And the central government has decreed that there will be a wine industry, and a large one, so it will happen.
I heard the reason they were doing that was because you can't grow grapes where you grow rice. So there wasn't a conflict with, as an alcohol beverage, it was sort of steamed.
Well, it's a bit like that. They make what's, I think, undoubtedly the world's worst alcoholic beverage there. I forget the name of it, but it's a still product out of wheat. And it smells and tastes foul. Absolutely dreadful. And the government wants to reduce their production of that, use the wheat for food, and switch people on to wine.
Okay. So what sort of things are going on in China in terms of wine production?
Well, there's quite a few overseas investors coming in, and there's some wealthy individuals in China who, and nearby Asia, that are investing there. And because the government wants wine production to happen, and that command has been passed down the chain of command down to the town and village level, they're very keen for people to move into their area and develop vineyards and wineries. You probably don't know this, but when China entered the world apple market, they sort of turned it upside down, because they produce so many apples. We're familiar now that China produces so many manufactured goods. Mm. I mean, many of the goods we buy in our shops are produced in China, whereas, you know, maybe 20 years ago there weren't so many Chinese ones, there were more Japanese ones.
Or Korean.
So in the same way, I think we're going to just start hearing more about China. And it's an interesting question about whether they'll ever develop an export wine business. You know, probably people might have said a while ago, well, they couldn't have done it with apples, or maybe they couldn't have even done it with their manufactured goods. So I don't know. They've got a lot of resources, and they're keen for value-added agricultural products because it helps solve some of the problems they've got of rural poverty.
What about the fact that there's no land ownership in China?
Well, you get a long-term lease, that's not a problem.
Oh, so the way that you set up a vineyard in China, if, let's say, Constellation went into China, they would get a long-term lease for that land, develop it.
Yeah.
Well, is that the process?
Yeah, that's right. But, I mean, I've never heard of Constellation
just making that up. I was just thinking of some big multinational going in.
Yeah.
Okay, so you do it through long-term leasing.
Yeah.
Okay. What sort of regions in China should people think about in terms of wine production?
Well, I'm not going to be too specific because the clients I'm working with have paid a lot of money to have these regions detailed. No, I'm serious, because we've done very comprehensive studies of the climate. But I can tell you in general, if you look at the coastal areas of China, it's very hot. So because it's very hot, we tend not to get good wines. It's very humid, and also for that reason, the wine quality can be compromised. But more particularly, it rains at the wrong time of the year. In August, September, it rains a lot, and that causes you all sorts of problems. Yeah. Now, as you go inland, it gets cooler.
Is that
and
altitude?
That's good. Not necessarily. You just get away from the coastal influence. Some of it's altitude, but not totally.
I thought coastals are normally more moderate climate areas.
Well, it depends on what the ocean temperature is. But anyway, as you get inland in China, you're getting into the middle of the Asian and European land mass. It's just more continental and more cold. Well, more cold in winter, I should say. The summers can be hot, but the winter gets so cold that they have to bury the vines or they won't survive.
Yep.
But anyway, within that area, effectively more or less west of Beijing, more or less, you get into better areas.
Tried some wine from around Shandong. And it was all right. It wasn't fantastic, but it was well made and it tasted all right.
Yeah, many of the wines you see have got some basic winemaking faults and basic viticulture faults, but, I mean, when they learn how to do it, they'll do very well.
What about grape varieties? What sort of things are they growing?
Well, they're tending to grow the same ones that everyone else does around the world, but they're doing quite well. There's a couple of varieties that are well-suited there. They don't do a bad Cabernet Sauvignon. They've selected a local grape they call Cabernet Guernichet, and its origin's a bit clouded. It may even be Carmenere, I was told in my last visit. And Carmenere, you may know, is a Bordeaux variety that was taken to Chile and thought to be Merlot for a long time. Anyway, I'm not sure if that's true. And then they also have Riesling Tokay, I forget the other name for it. Oh, Sauvignon Vert, that's it. Or Tokay Frulliano. That does quite well there. It's a white.
Is that not Frulliano from Italy?
It is, yeah.
Oh, it's the same?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And that's growing there as well?
Yeah, yeah. So they have a number of varieties. But I've had some quite good wines here. I've had some good Syrah wines. Yeah, so I think it's quite a good place for investment, although it's, you know, it's a difficult place to do business.
How long before they really get volume together?
Oh, I don't know that I can answer that, but I would guess within 10 to 20 years they'll be having an impact on the world's wine trade.
So keep an eye out for them in 10 to 20.
Yeah, I mean, Australia's had an impact in 10 to 20 years, so has Chile, South Africa, so it's a reasonable time span.
It gives, I suppose that's from planting to give a couple of vintages off and then...
Yeah, and getting you've got to get critical volume and critical quality before people start to take notice of you.
Are they doing it internally or are they really looking to partner?
Oh, a bit of both. Yeah. Partnerships are pretty common.
Yeah. I suppose that gives them information transfer.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
They could just hire a viticulturist like yourself and not have to partner?
They could, yeah.
Okay then, Richard, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, cheers, mate.
China's starting to make good progress, and last year the Canadians started teaching the Chinese how to make ice wine. With tax changes in Hong Kong, which could see it become a power trading centre for fine wines of the world, China is gearing up to embrace wine. The question for me is, will they become a net importer or a net exporter? Before we finish up though, how are you getting on with that quote? Good wine is a good familiar creature, if well used. Well, it's said by Iago, a character in the play Othello, written by William Shakespeare. So if you said William Shakespeare, top points. Until next week, cheers! And good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.